Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive, from 1987, written and directed, again, by Larry Cohen. Now, given that 9-year delay between the second and third installment, you might think that this was a desperate director looking to cash in on past glories, but Cohen had been working hard and making some great movies during that time. He made Full Moon High, Q, The Winged Serpent, and The Stuff, all iconic video store classics of the 80s, and a couple of lesser gems like Special Effects and Perfect Strangers. Not, I want to stress, the one with Balky and Larry. This is about a hitman who tries to seduce his way into a woman's life so he can murder her son. And in fact, this movie got its start when he was pitching another project, a remake of the movie House of Wax from 1953, according to Michael Doyle's 2015 book Larry Cohen, The Stuff of Gods and Monsters. Between this and King Cohen, I'm glad he lived long enough to see himself remembered by a whole generation who grew up loving his films. The House of Wax remake didn't happen, but as often does happen during these pitch meetings, Cohen was asked if he had any other ideas in the works. Warner Brothers was particularly interested in the notion of making a direct-to-video sequel to one of the properties they already had the rights to. This was at the very dawn of the direct-to-video era, when the idea of making a low-budget sequel to an existing movie and releasing it straight into video stores was only beginning to catch on as the future cash cow it would one day become. Cohen mentioned that he had an idea for a sequel to the 1979 TV miniseries Salem's Lot that he'd been trying to get made for a while, and offered them a two-for-one deal. If they let him make a return to Salem's Lot, he'd give them another sequel to It's Alive, and he'd shoot them back-to-back with the same crew to save costs. Warner Brothers agreed, and even wound up giving the movies a limited theatrical release, putting Cohen into the position of having to now figure out exactly what a third film in the series would look like and what it would have to say. Ultimately, he decided he would need to make good on the promise of the first two films and show both the development of the babies into maturity and the ultimate judgment of society on whether they could be treated as human beings. Having shown them as objects of revulsion in the first movie and a subject of societal clashes in the second, the logical progression would be to finally show them gaining acceptance and then showing what that might mean for individuals so very different and potentially dangerous. This meant casting yet another father figure for the mutant infants, and I find it so interesting that these are all films about fatherhood, even though the mothers in each movie play a key role, because so often fathers are portrayed in media as detached and disconnected from their children, and the mother is seen as the quintessential parental figure, and this is a series that's all about finding paternal affection for even the most unusual of kids. And for this film and A Return to Salem's Lot, Cohen went back to his longtime creative collaborator Michael Moriarty, who he first worked with on Q and returned to for The Stuff in 1985. Moriarty's loose improvisational performance style worked well with Cohen's own impulse to look at the script as more of a roadmap than a blueprint, something that made Moriarty's career outside of Cohen's films something of a checkered one. His four-season run on Law & Order ended when he got into a personal feud with Attorney General Janet Reno, of all people, accusing the federal government of censoring the series and behaving in a manner the production described as erratic. Now, that was only one of almost 90 credits in film and television dating back to 1971. Others include Troll, Pale Rider, and Bang the Drum Slowly, but there's no question he's developed a reputation as a contentious and eccentric actor and person. He's also become something of a right-wing crank, with politics that go even further than the usual Trumpist nonsense and well into rants about fiat currency and similar obsessions. I don't even know if he's still employable. Playing the infant's mother, Ellen, is Karen Black, who is an icon of genre films right up until her death in 2013. That's not to say she only did genre work. She was in a number of critically acclaimed mainstream movies we've mentioned before on this podcast, from Easy Rider to Nashville to Come Back to the Five and Dime Jimmy Dean, Jimmy Dean, where she plays the post-transition version of the character Mark Patton from A Nightmare on Elm Street 2 plays in flashback. But everyone remembers her from Trilogy of Terror or Hitchcock's last movie Family Plot. Cohen apparently joked with her on set that she drove the famous director into retirement, or Burnt Offerings, or Capricorn 1, or the Invaders from Mars remake, or House of a Thousand Corpses, always giving her ferocious energy to larger-than-life and highly memorable roles. She is still deeply missed. And it wouldn't be an It's Alive movie without James Dixon returning as Lieutenant Perkins, a bit older and wiser, but still unable to avoid entanglement in the strange saga of the mutant children. Sadly, I must report that between my recording of the It Lives Again episode and this one, James Dixon passed away at the age of 86 in Santa Monica, survived by his three children. He's been a highlight of this series of films, and he seemed like someone who was enjoying his life and career as a creator and collaborator. I hope I convey my respect for him on this podcast, even though I am going to have to talk about some of his more interesting creative choices here. And while this is a film with a very large cast, it's also a film with a very broad focus. So rather than start off with a lengthy list of actors who will only appear in a single vignette and be left behind as the story moves on, let's dive right into the frankly wild plot and pick up the names as we go along, shall we? We begin on a rainy night in New York, where a taxi driver played by Kevin O'Connor flags down a cop played by John Worley to warn him that there's a woman giving birth in the backseat of his cab. She's played by Gil Gatsby, and you can already see what I mean about a large cast. The cop tries to help deliver the baby while the driver freaks out about the potential mess in his car, but when the baby comes out, that becomes the least of everyone's worries, as the baby turns out to be another mutant. The cop mortally wounds it before being killed himself, and although we don't see what happened to the taxi driver, it doesn't look good for him. If this scene sounds familiar to you, by the way, it may be because it was lifted for use in the Dirty Harry sequel, The Deadpool, and attributed to a sleazy Hollywood producer whose murder Dirty Harry is investigating. Cohen ruefully commented that more people probably saw the clip in The Deadpool without ever knowing it was a real movie than in the film it came from. The next day, Lieutenant Perkins is called in to investigate the dead baby, which crawled into a nearby church and died in a bit of slightly on-the-nose symbolism, and we get a little dialogue that establishes the mutants are coming faster and faster, and the authorities' efforts to murder them all at birth can't fully keep up. It's also here that I must point out, and my deepest apologies to the late James Dixon, that the production has chosen to give him a bushy mustache and a bowl cut that makes him look so much like children's television host Captain Kangaroo that you will not be able to look at a single scene he's in without being distracted by the resemblance. Seriously, it's uncanny. The opening credits then roll, with Bernard Herrmann's legendary theme playing over a photo-negative version of a rushing waterfall. Herrmann had passed away by the time this movie was filmed, with Laurie Johnson doing the score, but they still used his theme for the credits. The makeup effects were also done by a different person as well, Dan Fry instead of Rick Baker, but Daniel Pearl did return as director of photography. When we come out of the credits, it's to that courtroom scene we've been promised, with a prosecutor named Ralston, played by the legendary Garrett Graham, who was in everything from Demon Seed to Chopping Mall to Chud 2, but who I'll always remember as Franklin Sherman on The Critic, where he delivered the funniest joke ever written, arguing to a judge played by MacDonald Carey of Days of Our Lives fame, and by fame I mean he did over 3,000 episodes of the legendary soap opera over almost 30 years. Right up until his death in 1994, that the mutant babies are purely monstrous animals that have to be put down for the good of society. The courtroom is a bit of a circus, with expert witness Dr. Brewster, played by Neil Israel, and Stephen Jarvis, father of one of the children in question, interjecting with multiple outbursts and... Okay, I can't just leave it there. The joke is that the Shermans have booked a flight on an airline that turns out to be incredibly slipshod about safety, and when Franklin goes up to the cockpit to see what the matter is, he discovers that to save money they've hired a penguin to act as pilot. Franklin is at first outraged, but then terrified as he exclaims, "Wait a second, penguins can't fly?" And frankly, they should have just stopped bothering with comedy then and there, because you're never going to beat that joke. Okay, with that out of my system, let's go on. Ralston decides to pull a courtroom stunt by bringing in one of the babies to be examined, knowing that Stephen is terrified of his own son, whatever he might say in court, and his revulsion for the infant will sell the idea that these are monsters that even their own parents can't truly love. But when the baby tears open its cage, and we finally get some of the stop-motion babies I've been waiting for since the 1974 original, Stephen overcomes his fear and takes the infant into his arms, giving an impassioned speech to the terrified judge that the baby is only lashing out because it's frightened and everyone's been reacting to it with hostility and violence. The best part of this scene is when Stephen speaks directly to his son in the cage, telling him that there's an asshole out there just hoping he'll make a scene and justify the need to murder him, all while Ralston is standing 2 feet away, silently fuming. It's hilarious. Needless to say, the stunt backfires on Ralston, and the judge is convinced that a solution needs to be found that accommodates the needs of the mutant children without putting society at risk. And by the way, Moriarty continues the trend in this series of taking the emotionally affecting material with absolute sincerity. His line, "How would you feel if you were born into a world that looked at you and wanted you dead?" feels like a commentary on queerness, on disability, on race, on every kind of marginalization, and I defy you not to watch it and feel a little bit of something deep down in your heart. This movie would not work without his commitment, because the second it goes into intentional camp, it's done. This is a movie that means something, as silly and strange as it gets, and it's not kidding around about the important stuff at all. That's why everything else around it can get as wild as it does without compromising the integrity of the story. To me, at least. While the judge deliberates, Stephen goes down to Florida to visit his ex-wife Ellen at her job at a supper club in Cape Vale, telling her that the babies are going to be safe and there haven't been any new incidences in over 2 months. But Ellen tells him that she's had her tubes tied, she's unable to even think about being intimate with him without grieving for the child she thought they were going to have, and their relationship is definitively over despite his love and longing for her. It's an immensely sad moment, and it's no surprise that Stephen decides to work out his frustrations by throwing some baseballs at the nearby carnival on the boardwalk. While he's there, a local sex worker named Sally, played by Laureen Landon, decides to proposition him for an evening's companionship, and Stephen's sad and lonely enough to accept. The two of them make love, but when she comments that he looks familiar, he closes up emotionally and tries to head out before she can figure out where she knows him from. He tells her he's a former actor who did some commercials, but she finally recognizes him as Stephen Jarvis, father of a monster baby and center of a famous court case that's all over the media, and she reacts with visceral horror at the notion that she might have been contaminated by whatever resulted in the mutation affecting his son. She tells him there should be a law forcing him to tell women who he is before he has sex with them, in a scene that was 100% deliberately intended to be a metaphor on the way people with HIV were treated in the era. Stephen leaves, feeling more alone and isolated than ever. The judge decides to exile the 5 surviving babies to an isolated and secret location where they can grow up safe from the violence inflicted on them by the human race, and humanity can stay safe from them. As always, the solution in these movies is never, "Hey, let's try cuddling the children and being compassionate with them and just see what happens." A commission is formed to look for a suitable place for them, and we then jump ahead some months to an expedition sent to a remote and inaccessible jungle island by the head of a pharmaceutical corporation, played by William Watson, who's probably best known to genre fans for The Sword and the Sorcerer. He explains to his subordinates that they're there to take care of a little private business. The fertility drug they took off the market was responsible for the mutations, and naturally they can't put it back out for sale if there's still uncomfortable reminders of its potential side effects still lingering around. So after bribing their way into finding out the island's location, they're going to kill the surviving babies, rebrand the medicine, and keep the profits rolling, and I wish I could pretend this was an even remotely unrealistic take on late-stage capitalism. Thankfully, this plan goes about as well as you might expect, with every man on the expedition being murdered by mutant babies, including the helicopter pilot who ignores the last survivor running for the chopper, only to find that a baby has snuck on board to attack him. They wind up detonating the helicopter in midair in a hilariously unconvincing but still very fun model shot. So yes, we've got a deserted island where the misfit creations of science are allowed to live undisturbed because they are, after all, nature's creatures, only to be hunted by an expedition that plans to exploit them for profit and winds up in over their heads. Let's just put a pin in that, shall we? Months later, on the mainland, Stephen's attorney Robbins, played by Patch McKenzie, breaks the bad news to him at a party. She didn't take the case pro bono, and she still needs to be paid. With Stephen now unemployable as an actor and the case unpopular as a charity, she plans on having a book ghostwritten for him about the incident to raise some money, and she's brought him to the event to meet with a publisher. Stephen threatens to denounce the book, and the publisher is delighted to hear it. Controversy only helps sales, after all. Unable to stop the book from being published due to the rights he signed away in his legal papers, and frustrated by the polite and genteel way everyone's exploiting his lurid family tragedy, Stephen decides to make a scene by signing autographs as Stephen Jarvis, father of the monster, and repeating all the sick jokes people have been saying behind his back about his child. Did you hear they brought the Jarvis baby in for shots? Yeah, he stole the gun away from the doctor. That kind of thing. It's the sort of joke that always goes around quickly in the wake of a tragedy because everyone copes in different ways, and turning something shocking and awful into a joke deflects the emotional impact from it and allows us some emotional distance to process. I remember a ton of them after the Challenger disaster when I was a kid, and I doubt things have changed much since then. The book comes out, an instant bestseller, and Ellen buys a copy before burning it in her fireplace out of anger. I kind of wish we'd gotten more of Ellen's side of this, even though I understand that because she's very deliberately distanced herself from her child and is trying to live under a new identity, it's kind of hard to get her involved in the plot. But she goes from working as a waitress at a supper club to having a boyfriend with a house that has its own very nice fireplace, and by the time we see her next, she'll be in a cheap apartment complex with a guy who's harassing her for sex, and the supper club will have turned into a punk dive bar. That sounds like a story I'd like to hear more about. We then jump ahead a good 4 years, although of course none of the adult characters look a day older because that is the way of these things, and Stephen is working in a shoe store to make ends meet. But the bitter, sullen temperament he's cultivated in the wake of the Jarvis baby trial and its ruinous effect on his life and career hasn't exactly left him suited for customer service, and he argues with a child over her shoe size while refusing another family's returns. Both leave in a huff, and Moriarty shouts after them, "Plunk your magic twang a froggy!" Which sounds so surreal and inexplicable that you could be excused for thinking that the actor wasn't just improvising but had in fact suffered some kind of head trauma on set, but it does make sense to audiences of a certain age. See, way, 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 way back in the early 1900s, a shoe company named Brown Shoes made a deal with the creator of newspaper comic strip Buster Brown to make Buster the mascot for their new line of kids' shoes, Buster Brown Shoes. Buster Brown Shoes sponsored at first a radio and then a television show, known alternately as The Buster Brown Show and as Smilin' Ed's Gang after its host. The TV version later became Andy's Gang after Ed McConnell died and was replaced by Andy Devine. And one of the recurring characters was a talking frog named Froggy the Gremlin, who played pranks and music interchangeably and who the host summoned by saying, "Plunk your magic twanga, Froggy!" So the connection from shoe store to shoe-sponsored old-time radio show catchphrase is there, albeit probably invisibly to anyone born after 1950. Or anyone who doesn't pick up random pop culture trivia like an old TV screen collects dust. I think I might have first heard about this from Cecil Adams in The Straight Dope, although I did need to refresh myself on the details through Wikipedia. As he closes up the shop, Stephen gets a visit from Lieutenant Perkins. He's there to break the news that Judge Watson has passed away, and Dr. Brewster has now gotten permission to visit the children on their remote island and see what 4 years of development have done for the kids. And because Perkins and Jarvis both have close personal experience with the mutant infants, he wants them to come along and provide their advice to the scientists for the expedition. That would be Dr. Svensson, played by Art Lund, and Dr. Morell, played by Anne Dane respectively, although there are a number of non-speaking crew members. Members of the crew of the boat, not of the crew of the movie. It turns out that the scientists also plan to bring back at least one subject for dissection, according to Morell, who promises to Stephen that it won't be his kid they murder. When Stephen reacts with entirely understandable disgust to her plan to slaughter a 5-year-old child that the courts have ruled to be a sentient human being, she gets sulky and stays that way for the rest of her time in the movie. I don't think I've ever seen petulant about not being allowed to kill little kids as a performance choice anywhere else, but that's just what makes Coen such a unique and fascinating filmmaker. He lets his actors do things nobody else would. After satisfying himself that Brewster's tranquilizer rifles won't do permanent harm to the kids by shooting Brewster with one, Stephen agrees to join the expedition, and they sail out into the wide expanse of ocean to the small, deserted, slightly radioactive island chosen for the kids. James Dixon immediately decides to break character. I love the man, I love this choice, but I absolutely cannot connect the Los Angeles cop he played in every previous scene of the trilogy with the kvetching Jewish New Yorker he suddenly starts deciding to play here. And Steven decides to deliberately antagonize Morrell at every turn with a series of come-ons intended to keep her away rather than getting her into bed with him. Oh, and Brewster is almost continually seasick. And Steven learns how to steer the ship from the captain to give himself something to do. And then they all start singing Oddest to God sea shanties. I think you could have given me 100 guesses and I wouldn't have picked that to happen in this movie. They finally arrive at the island, so now, interestingly enough, we have an expedition that was there to exploit and hunt these unusual and deadly but ultimately innocent natural creatures, and a second expedition that's just there to study them and find out how they've been doing since this jungle island was declared off-limits to visitors, and both expeditions failed to prepare for the lethal reality of their quarry and wound up the hunted instead of the hunter. Gosh, if that doesn't sound a lot like The Lost World, the sequel to Jurassic Park, where two expeditions head to the island full of wild dinosaurs and wind up in similarly dire straits that was made a full decade later. The two groups arrive at the same time in that story, but it's still so familiar that I can't imagine there wasn't some influence between the two, even though I also can't imagine Michael Crichton and Steven Spielberg seeing the third installment in a series of exploitation films about mutant babies. Predictably, things go very, very wrong very, very fast. The group finds scuba gear on the island, indicating that their quarry has already been contaminated with contact from the outside world. This doesn't appear to be the hunters from earlier. And both Brewster and Swenson are killed by the mutant kids, although not before Swenson manages to tranquilize one. Morrell and Perkins flee back to the beach while Steven pretends to shoot the tranquilized child, but only fires a round into the air. As the survivors regroup next to the rafts, Morrell is killed, and Perkins and Steven get back to the boat only to find the entire crew dead and the four surviving children in control of the vessel. Perkins dives back into the water and swims for shore to escape them, the only character to appear in and survive all three movies, and the mutants, who are now almost the same height as adult humans with bulky, muscular physiques and massive, oversized heads, force Steven to steer them in the direction of Cape Vale, Florida. The next section of the movie involves a lot of voiceover narration and conversation with himself from Steven, and it is a tour de force of over-the-top performance from Michael Moriarty. He discovers that his son and one of the other mutants have conceived a child together, making him a grandfather, and that they're slowly using the dead crew members for food. After stripping their clothes and putting them on themselves, an interesting and weird development that's never satisfactorily explained. He speculates that they communicate telepathically with each other and can read his mind, confirmed when he begins to hear their voices in his head, and realizes that they're trying to get back to Ellen for reasons he doesn't understand. Eventually, as the food runs out, the three mutants not related to Steven begin to get more aggressive toward him, and his son tosses him out into the ocean in sight of a passing ship with a chunk of wood to use as a raft. There are some lovely shots of Moriarty on the tiny little floating platform, with nothing around him but the wide, open ocean, that make him look so incredibly small and isolated and alone in a way his character has been ever since the child was born and his life was changed forever. Pearl really has some breathtaking camera work here, I'll be honest. Steven washes up in Cuba, where he's immediately taken for an American spy by a group of slightly cringy Cuban soldiers played by Carlos Palomino and Tony Abatamarco with a, well, let's just say over-the-top accent. He tries to warn them of the situation, and they very quickly go from, "Tell us everything," to, "Look, pal, we don't want to know your life story," as Steven gives them a long, rambling speech about everything that's happened to him over the last 5 years. It's a very weird twist to pop up with less than 30 minutes left in the movie, but it's nothing compared to what happens next. Back at Cape Vale, the supper club Ellen works at has reinvented itself as a punk music venue, and the boardwalk has been colonized by violent bikers and similar lowlifes. And let me just say how much I absolutely loved seeing the 80s new wave aesthetic so perfectly representing itself in the costumes here. I think Cohen might have just emptied out an actual New York nightclub and put its members on film, even if the music sounds more like 70s punk than what it would eventually evolve into by this time. On her way home from work, Ellen's stopped by a sleazy wannabe boyfriend who offers her a ride home, Tony, played by Rick Garia. She initially turns him down, but when he mentions that he found an old book in the remainders pile at his local bookstore about mutant babies with her picture in it, and he'd hate to have to show it to all her friends, she reluctantly changes her mind. She doesn't know that her son and his friends have made it to Cape Vale, and they've crashed the boardwalk looking for her. But Stephen does know, and in one of the most bizarre and hilarious plot developments in this or any other movie, he somehow managed to convince the two Cuban soldiers off-screen that he's on the level, that he really is the father of a mutant baby that's grown up and made his way to the coast of Florida, and that they need to risk an international incident by smuggling him back to the States to look for him. They give Stephen a gun and express their warm friendship and firm camaraderie for each other with solid handshakes, rejecting the divisive hatred fomented by their respected governments. And this is such a weird and wild development that I feel like it's the make-or-break moment for the entire film. You're either on board with off-screen Cuban bromance or you're not, and I for one was ready to embrace the weirdness. The next bizarre and inexplicable plot point is a full-on boardwalk rumble between punks and greasers over who's going to be the one to sexually assault a pretty young woman who looks like she's cosplaying as Sandy from Grease. And, well, I'm normally against sexualized peril as a plot device, this situation is so artificial and unintentionally campy, and it was so clear and obvious right from the beginning that it would end with her saved and all of her pursuers being killed by mutant children, that I was able to cut it a certain amount of slack simply because I knew she was never in any real danger, and the film more or less presented it as such. This is just how we get a late movie sequence of mutant babies versus bikers and punks, and I can't really be mad at that. The rumble ends with the cops showing up, arresting most of the survivors, and killing one of the mutant kids. The other mutants head to Ellen's apartment, where they maul Tony to death after Ellen rejects first his advances, then his attempt at blackmail. Karen Black's insult, "What a ridiculous human being you make," has to be one of the most genteel yet cutting things I can imagine one person saying to another. Stephen finds out where she lives from her co-workers and arrives shortly after Ellen is pulled up onto the roof by the kids. The first body, meanwhile, is taken away by the medical examiners and discovered to be coated head to toe with a mysterious rash. In the end, Stephen and Ellen learn that the mutants are all dying of measles. They never got any of their childhood inoculations. See, that sick joke from earlier was actually foreshadowing. And when the quarantine was broken multiple times over the years, they were infected with diseases they had no defense against. So yes, this is a pro-vaccination story. I'm all for it. They came to Cape Vale to give their baby to his grandparents so they could find some way to care for him and give him the life they never had. And once that's done, they willingly sacrifice themselves to give Stephen and Ellen the chance to escape unseen by the arriving police, who fight the monsters on the roof and, when hit, tumble into what appears to be a bottomless pit right behind the apartment building. So I hope Ellen at least got a discount on her rent out of the whole deal. Stephen and Ellen take the baby and steal a car, driving away into the night to an uncertain future with a child who may or may not survive long enough to find a sympathetic doctor. And yet, the discovery that their child was a human being in the end, who trusted them to care for their own infant, heals something between the two of them, and they can't stop laughing as they speed off. It's the closest this franchise has ever gotten to a happy ending. And it gives you just the tiniest bit of hope that maybe this time, the cycle of fear and violence won't repeat itself again. And will I hang on to this movie? Honestly, I think it might be my favorite of the series. It's weird, it tries to do way too much with its limited production budget, and it often veers into unintentional camp, but it's sweet and beautifully sincere, and it really takes the premise of the first film and runs with it in a way that I think a lot of filmmakers would have been afraid to. This is a movie that makes big choices and commits to them hard, and I love it for that, and I'm keeping it on my shelf so I can show it to everyone I know and say to them, "Can you believe this?" And if you want to talk about off-screen Cuban romances, Froggy and his magic twanger, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, It's been a while since we've done a movie featuring the legendary Barbara Crampton, and another while since we've done one featuring the equally legendary Jeffrey Combs. And because there's a movie out there that not only features both of them together, but also the great Ken Foree, I thought we might take a step back to 1986 and tackle the gorgeous slice of cosmic body horror from yet another legend, Stuart Gordon, and his Lovecraft adaptation, From Beyond. See you then.